From the Sky News Centre at 6, the FIFA presidential election is going to a second round of voting. Neither of the candidates got two-thirds of the 209 votes from the footballing organisations that was necessary to win on the first round. The second stage will require either Prince Ali bin Al Hussein or Sepp Blatter to get a majority. Just before voting started, the Prince made this final appeal on FIFA TV.
We stand here today at a crossroads for football, and it will take a committed leader to fix this mess that we are in. I will be proud to shoulder the responsibility for fixing our governing body.
Meanwhile, the UK's Serious Fraud Office says it's actively investigating alleged corruption material despite claims they've known about it for 4 years. A judge says a 19-year-old was as callous as he was manipulative in grooming a young man with learning difficulties to carry out a terror attack. He's been sentenced to 8 years for attempting to persuade the man to buy ingredients for a pipe bomb and target soldiers with a knife. The mother of two children who died on a Thomas Cook holiday in Corfu in 2006 has criticised a charity donation made by the holiday firm's ex-chief executive. Sharon Wood says Harriet Green's decision is an attempt to gain public empathy. Staff at the steel giant Tata have voted overwhelmingly in favour of strike action in a row over pensions. The company wants to extend workers' retirement age from 60 to 65. And a 1988 Nobel Prize in Physics has been sold at auction for more than £500,000. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message. I love you. Now, back to our show.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM. 93.2.
I see many aspects of a phenomenon which I'm just beginning to understand. Our modern technology has achieved a degree of sophistication beyond our wildest dreams, but this technology has exacted a pretty heavy price. We live in an age of anxiety, a time of stress, and with all our sophistication, we are, in fact, the victims of our own technological strength. We are the victims of shock, of future shock.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Assad. Now, the Western media is calling for regime change at FIFA. How very unsporting of them. And the latest from Switzerland is that Blatter has 133 votes. Ali is only 75, so it looks like Blatter's going to stay in. And Saddam Hussein and Colonel Gaddafi, well, is this really the sort of thing that's going on now with many Western influential people trying to bring down the head of FIFA? Also, the West and the FBI are crying corruption over there, but they're trying to get the Sandhurst-trained Jordanian general in as president. We ask, is there no international institution the West's New World Order don't want to take over? Why do they make the point of the root of the problem being around the assassination of John F. Kennedy? That's the New World Order. So we'll be talking about that in the next hour. Also, Cuba and the Palestine connection. Is there one? Well, Jackie Cannon used to work as a translator for the Cuban national newspaper, and Aristides Rodriguez is a health writer and researcher from Cuba. They're in town and doing a talk in a few weeks' time, but we get a sneak preview tonight with them. They're joining us here in the studio. Plus, Martin Summers' chance, as he has every week, to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. And we'll start there, Martin. What's been happening this week? Is there anything you'd like to point out about things going on around the world?
Well, the key thing that springs to mind is the vote in the Ukrainian Rada out of a moratorium on their debt repayments, and this being signed into law by Poroshenko. It means possibly that Ukraine is going to default. This could lead to a situation, you know, everybody's been focusing on Greece as the possible weakest link that's going to pull down the European economy, but it may be that the Ukraine is going to trump that.
Okay, also just bringing you live results from Switzerland, because as I said there, Blatter has got 133 votes and Prince Ali 73 votes in the first round, and in the second round only a simple majority is required, so it looks almost certain that Blatter is going to get in. This was quite important, wasn't it, though, for the 2018 Russian World Cup, because that's where it's happening now. If it had Prince Ali in charge, as it now looks he won't be in charge, of FIFA, what would that have meant for the Russians?
Well, I don't know, but the Russians have certainly perceived this as a hostile manoeuvre against them. I think the foreign ministry in Russia have been saying that they don't see any implications for Russia's hosting of the 2018 World Cup in what's happening in Zurich. But I think it's another one of these east-west confrontation points, basically.
Why is it? It does look as if that we've got the politics creeping into sport. Why is the importance of keeping them separate? Because, I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of Qatar, hasn't there? Particularly, this is a pretty nasty regime. Hundreds of construction workers, for example, been dying on the Olympic sites in Qatar. And yet everyone says it's fine.
Well, I don't think you can separate politics and sport, really. Even if you are going to say you're going to separate them, that's a political.
But should you
statement.
Be having sporting events in political areas that, you know, in countries that you don't agree with, for example?
Well, I think in principle, yes, unless there's a very overwhelmingly strong reason not to. So, for example, South Africa was kept out of international sport for many years, and rightly so, because the sports teams weren't integrated for a start. And that's obviously some of the, you know, it's bound to be a contentious area. Let's put it that way.
Okay, also in Syria, Al-Qaeda has seized the last city in Syria's Idlib province, and it seems that ISIS is extending its power. Saudi troops have been killed in Yemen, so it does look as if there are some Saudi troops now on the ground in Yemen too.
Well, pretty soon they may be on the ground in Syria too. These crises haven't gone away. I think the euro crisis, which is really a banking crisis, it's a crisis of the international banking system, is related now to the geopolitical conflicts going on between Russia and the West, and obviously this spills over into the Syrian conflict as well. It's a very dangerous moment in international affairs. Incidentally, of course, we've seen the Americans in a rather sneaky fashion trying to make friendly with the Cubans whilst trying to tighten sanctions against the Venezuelans. So they're playing sort of divide and rule tactics, I think.
Okay, well, time then to introduce Jackie Cannon and Aristides Rodriguez. Hi, the pair of you. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, thank you. Nice to be here.
Jackie, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about what you used to do, I imagine, actually living over in Cuba, working over there, were you?
Yes, I was working. I worked over there translating on the Granma newspaper.
And how did you end up doing that? You're English, are you?
I'm English. Yeah? I'm English.
So how does a young English woman end up over in Cuba doing translation on their magazine?
Oh, I'm flattered. I'm flattered by the young. How I end up doing that is because I met Aristides, and one of these international love stories, and partly to do with the difficulty of how you get someone from a country which is declared by the United States principally as a state sponsoring terrorism to have a residence in this country, and it looked more sensible at that time for me to go over to Cuba.
So what was the, I mean, how did you find life over there after being brought up over here then?
Well, I spent...
Apart from hot, I imagine it's hot.
It's hot most of the year, yes, and it's very humid, and you can get used to the weather. You can adapt to the weather. And there were certain things. I've spent quite a lot of time living and working in Spain. I used to teach Spanish. And what I expected was that in Cuba I'd find a lot of things which were familiar. And it probably went as far as some of the buildings. I recognised some of the architecture. And then I found that the people were just very welcoming. It seems that they have very little, and whatever little they have, they're willing to share it. And I wanted to be with Addis, as I call him. So we decided I had the opportunity to apply for a job translating on the newspaper. And I became very aware through that as well that a lot of things that are presented as the truth about Cuba and about that region of the world are presented with a certain influence, which is not always, what might I say, accurate. So that's it was a great learning experience, an absolutely fantastic learning experience, a steep learning curve, and hugely beneficial in terms of my understanding, my ability to offer, to ask questions of people.
Well, and look, give us an example of something that you saw that you were able to report in your newspaper, which you saw at one angle where you thought the rest of the world was getting a different angle.
Okay. So one thing I've seen, well, in fact, particularly if we look at the United States and Cuba's renewal of relationships, that's actually come after I was working at the newspaper, so I didn't, this wasn't something I was translating on, but I have followed it, of course, and it seems to me that a lot of what's been said is that, that President Obama has been presented as the very generous leader who has offered to make life better for Cubans. And I think as our previous speaker mentioned, it could be seen as a sneaky move, because and one thing, when I looked at the Raul Castro's speech on the same day, 17th of December,
now, what was presented? Raul Castro, is he the current president? He's the son of Fidel Castro.
No, he's the brother.
Brother, okay.
He's the brother of Fidel Castro, and he's quite old as well.
It's a bit like a monarchy, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't call it a monarchy, because it's a popular revolution. It's almost
like having a popular king, someone who's all from the people or something.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's just my version of how I understand the monarchy, which aren't elected and aren't actually backed by many of the people. And that's not actually the case in Cuba. The revolutionary government is supported by, from my understanding, the majority of Cubans. And one of the things that I noticed is when Raul Castro made his announcement on the 17th of December, when Obama made his, Castro, Raul, as the Cubans call him, because he's like a family member, so he was talking, and everything he said was a reference to socialism. And yet that was presented in the foreign press, or much of the foreign press, as communist. Now, the party in Cuba is the Cuban's Communist Party. But that's just the name of the party. The principles are socialist. And that's it's kind of by persistently referring to the system as communist, it kind of demonizes it, in my view, and almost puts in the mind of people, oh, well, that'll go the way that previous communist regimes have gone. So, you know, just hold on.
Fascinating. Anyway, Aristides, is that the right way to pronounce it? Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do in Cuba? Because you're actually Cuban yourself, aren't you?
What Aris was saying there is he's lived all his life in Cuba. And he still lives there. So we share our time. And what he was doing in Cuba was he previously worked... So he's lived all his life, apart from time he spent abroad either studying or on international missions, as they call them, abroad. He's worked in the communications sector in Cuba, and then he spent 25 years as a what they call electromedical, which is essentially maintaining the equipment, medical equipment, so that it's part medical training. And he was in, obviously, the Cuban health service, which is world-renowned.
So you're, I mean, it's a, I suppose, when we're talking about socialism just now, a bit like our National Health Service. And what's your experience of the Cuban Health Service? How, you know, what are the differences between what we've got here in Britain? Just about still.
It has to be just about still. My experience of the Cuban Health Service is that a lot of people go to the doctors, you know, like the health is a major thing. Interesting, when on television you don't hear, they don't have adverts, commercials, you know, so what they have in between TV programs is health alerts or reminders to check to make sure there's no bacteria for, or no, you know, like if there's a health alert for dengue or something like that. And I actually had a bit of a scare while I was working over there, that in our locality there was one person who died from cholera, and I displayed some of the symptoms, and the attention I got was unbelievable. I mean, it was like two doctors and three nurses came and visited me at the house for over the space of 3 days until they were sure that, yeah, I didn't have cholera.
Amazing. Martin, I seem to remember that Hugo Chavez actually was taken to Cuba because it was considered in Latin America the best place for medical treatment.
Yes, he was. And, of course, there's still a lot of suspicions about why he died and how he died, because it was very, very peculiar circumstances.
Well, there's actually been quite a lot of South American leaders who have died in suspicious circumstances.
Indeed.
Of cancer. And people are saying, well, actually,
and very bizarre and unusual cancers.
Can you, Martin, give us a bit of your take before we hear from Jackie about some of the history? Because we can hear about the Palestine connection in a minute. But how did we arrive at the situation in the 1950s and the 1960s where there was actually a kind of popular revolution, an armed uprising right next door to the United States, right on their doorstep, that was successful and has been successful up until this day?
Well, I mean, you've just given a potted history of it.
But why? Why and how did that happen?
Because the previous Batista regime was loathed by the majority of the population, and to begin with, the revolution was not necessarily a socialist revolution. They attempted to negotiate with the United States, but the United States had no intention of negotiating, and we've been in a kind of hostile posture ever since. And incidentally, the idea that Cuba has now been taken off the list of countries supporting terrorism, which I find rather laughable, because Luis Posada, who was the terrorist who bombed the Cuban airliner in Venezuela back in the 70s, he's still at large in the United States and treated as an honoured guest, even though the guy blew up an airliner that killed hundreds of people.
And also, what about the connection with the JFK assassination? Because I know JFK had actually made an attempt to tone down what the US military wanted to do with the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Fidel Castro himself has suggested that it's not very likely that Oswald could have carried out the assassination. Basically, the US is actually an extremely violent and nasty country. Cuba is actually a model of restraint in comparison. But the real world is extremely messy, and I'm sure that the Cuban leadership realise that if there is an opening to the Americans, then they're going to have to find out whatever it is that's on offer. But I think it's very suspicious that they're being nice to the Cubans at the same stage as they're raising their hostility towards the Venezuelan government, which does in fact have straightforward bourgeois elections. So you can see that they're trying to play games, really.
It was 1959 when Batista was overthrown. This isn't really long, I suppose, 10 years or so after the end of the Second World War, but it's 15 years after the end of the Second World War. It did seem, didn't it, that the United States, after the end of World War II, was really, really, found it very important to assert its authority right across Latin America.
Well, they overthrew the Arbenz government in Guatemala in 1954. And which was an elected government, and they've overthrown many elected governments in the rest of Latin America. So you can see from the Cuban point of view, they're not prepared to play by those rules. And in a better circumstance, then we could perhaps talk about, you know, socialist reform inside Cuba. But I can see why the Cuban leadership doesn't want to talk about that when they're under constant attack.
Just a bit of news from FIFA. Blatter has retained his presidency and Prince Ali has withdrawn. So Sepp Blatter's survived for another 4 years or so as president of FIFA, to see FIFA through the World Cup over in Russia. Very interesting result, and we'll see what happens as that story develops in the future. I suppose I should really ask you, Jackie, what is the attitude these days towards the Americans in Cuba? Is it just simply suspicion still? Because it's sort of a massive nuclear superpower right on your doorstep. And, of course, Cuba was the place, wasn't it, in 1962, where the world nearly came to blows and nuclear war over what was going on there. But anyway, so what's the attitude to the Americans now?
So I think it's really interesting what our colleague here said about...
it's Martin Summers.
Summers. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name earlier. Right. So Martin, thank you. So what was interesting is when you say about the US... I had messages from friends saying, oh, you must be delighted that the blockade's come to an end. And it's like, here we are at the end of May, and the blockade still hasn't come to an end, despite the recognition, the renewal of diplomatic relationships. In terms of the... Cuba has still been on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, and midnight tonight is the deadline for that to be challenged. So at the moment, because apparently Congress is in recess this week, they don't expect anyone to dive in at the last minute and say, no, we're not okay with that. But in terms of how the Cubans are responding to it, they're responding largely with curiosity, but mainly caution, precisely because of what Martin said and what you said, Tony, about, you know, they've been hammered for so long that... President Obama said himself in his speech on the 17th of December, he said, in the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests. So, and he says immediately before that, at the beginning of his speech, today the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. And what's interesting is whenever you speak to, or in my experience, whenever I've spoken to Cubans in public authority or everyday Cubans, they have always said, we don't have a problem with the people of the U.S., we have a problem with the government. There was like 10 successive, I can't remember if it's 10 or 11, successive US governments that have followed the same repressive policy. And then President Obama is saying, you know, it's that policy is outdated and it's failed to advance our interests.
But I mean, a lot of people will look at America, the United States, they'll look at Cuba and say, well, the US is just way in advance, the technology, the standard of living, etc. So what was the point of the revolution?
That might be better to ask Harris, actually. Sure. The United States is seen as powerful and, you know, they look for more power. So, and the revolution is seen as a moral revolution. And it didn't happen just in 1959 when it triumphed. Back in 1953, there was the assault on the Moncada barracks or garrison, and that was part of the program of the revolution, and it was all part of the program to have a people's, a popular revolution, and Fidel's statement, legal statement on that was, history will absolve me. So it's seen as a moral victory, which is worth, you know, it was largely to defend themselves against the puppet government of Batista, which was obviously the strings of which were being pulled by the US. Cuban people were oppressed under that. A lot of them, you know, were living in hardship. under regulations where the greatest landowners and property owners were not Cubans. And so Cubans themselves now, they're aware of their history, so they view the new developments with caution, partly because they're proud of what they've achieved. Like, it's difficult to make it more difficult for the Cubans.
What about this whole business of standard of living, though? Because if you look at the United States and you look at Cuba, Cuba is quite largely rural. The US has got a very high standard of living. Martin, do you want to come
in? I just want to say, Tony, the comparison is not with Cuba and the United States. It's with Cuba and Haiti. People in Cuba could be living like the people of Haiti, but they don't. They live better than the people of Haiti. Okay. And that's the comparison, not the comparison with Florida. And that this is completely specious. And don't forget, the embargo has not made it easy to run the Cuban economy over 40 years.
Yeah. Okay. And that's also interesting. I mean, if you look up, if you check out the World Health statistics from the World Health Organization, you'll see the life expectancy, for example, in the US and Cuba is pretty much the same. And As you say, and it's interesting, Martin, that you mentioned the embargo, because pretty much in all of the Western countries, we talk about the embargo. The Cubans talk about the blockade, because it isn't just a few sanctions. It's a blockade which actually impacts third countries' relationships, business relationships with Cuba, and impacts very seriously. Aris got something he'd like to add here. Is that possible?
Okay, cool.
Well,
the US has a series of legally instituted laws which actually make it impossible for President Obama to overrule them by executive order. It has to go through Congress. They've been institutionalized in a series of laws which actually make it illegal for countries. So with they're legislating about the activities of third countries who trade with Cuba. And so that's not just making it a bit difficult. One thing they have done is they have over in the recent, well, since December, they have, I understand, lifted the restriction. It was the case that any ship that arrived at a Cuban port was not then allowed to dock at a US port for the next 6 months. So I understand they've lifted that. Another aspect is that the US government, actually, when a lot of people have said to me, oh, well, yeah, but Cuba, Americans can't go to Cuba. So Americans, and it's the assumption is that it's Cuba that doesn't allow them. And in terms of when we look at, as I mentioned earlier, people of Cuba and institutions in Cuba often say we don't have a problem with the people of America. What we have a problem with is the governments. And what's often happens is, so the people of the U.S., as far as Cuba is concerned, can travel to Cuba. But it's their own government, the U.S. government, which imposes sanctions.
Okay, well, let's cut to what we had at the top of the hour, and that is the link between Cuba and Palestine. What is this link? What is it all about?
Okay, so one of the things that revolutionary Cuba has always been committed to is the principles of self-determination, national sovereignty, and supporting the what they call just causes. So they've always been, they have a lot of international medical missions with countries around the world. They were the biggest group of doctors, for example, that went to, I understand, Haiti. They've been in Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. They've been in Nepal. So Cuba's solidarity activities are wide-ranging. And with Palestine, it was quite striking. In at the beginning of March, I think it might have been the 1st of March or the 8th of March, the Cuban foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez Parrilla, was actually addressing the United Nations. Now, given that that, I believe, was the first time he was addressing the United Nations since the renewal of diplomatic relations with the US, it might have been expected that he focused on how he wanted the US to see Cuba or the demands that Cuba had. But in his address to the UN, which I saw, it was relayed on Cuban television, he actually was calling for the for national sovereignties and the right to self-determination for the Palestinian people. And the key areas are the return of occupied lands, having Jerusalem as a capital, and peace, essentially. On as a result of that, Aris and I actually went and interviewed the Palestinian ambassador to Havana. And, you know, that was interesting, looking at the solidarity which we saw displayed in 2015. And it goes back to, well, certainly to the beginning of the triumph of the revolution. So you notice when we do our talk, Cuba Revolution, Solidarity in Palestine, it's actually, we've scheduled it on the 18th of June, which happens to be the anniversary of Che Guevara, when he was director of the National Bank of Cuba and also the Minister of the Economy, was sent by the revolutionary government to Gaza in a show of solidarity back in 1959. So just 6 months after the revolution triumphed.
Amazing. I mean, would it go so far, stretch so far, the Cuban policy, to supporting armed revolutionaries in other parts of the world? Or is it just a kind of diplomatic mission? I mean, that, you know, because it's what the US does, isn't it? It supports its people with guns around the world that it wants.
Yeah, that was
Martin, would you like to chip
well,
in on
that? One thing I can say is, out of the interview with the Palestinian ambassador, what he said is that the prime solid act of solidarity that had come from Cuba was political. So they weren't talking about armed struggle.
Certainly not at that time. Anyway, Martin, you know, the Cuban role in the world since the revolution has been, you know, quite big, really, in that, you know, that there's been this message go out from Cuba saying, look, we've done it, you can do it too.
Yeah, and of course, probably the most important intervention they made was to send troops to Angola in the next 70s and the Battle of Cuito Cinavale, where the apartheid war machine had its back broken by the Cuban army, and that was a key factor in the fall of the apartheid regime, and the, you know, Cuba's got that battle honour.
Okay, Jackie, I understand you've written a book, is that right? Cuba, One Moment in Time.
Yes. So it's not published as yet. It's in the final stages of editing, and it's basically came out of we were in Cuba from the middle of December through to the beginning of March this year, and I couldn't have anticipated that we were going to have such monumental news as renewal of diplomatic relations a week after we got there. And obviously I was speaking to tourists who were arriving and wondering how this was changing already. We were noticing in talking to Cubans how there was a different energy, if you like, and different types of conversations, some of them with some level of scepticism, some of them with some level of excitement. And I just thought, this is an historic moment, and I'm here and I'm living it. There were things on television, and I thought, it seems so essentially the book is my experience of being there. It's something that I've had the experience of being a tourist in Cuba. Now we have you know, our own place. We don't have to go as tourists. We go and we spend time in Cuba. And so I have a different experience, which isn't either the Cuban experience, because I'm privileged when I'm there. I go with hard currency. So the book is an attempt to kind of process my own understanding and also offer something else to people, which goes beyond what they normally read in English.
What would you say to people who have maybe seen pictures of Cuba, watched films about it or whatever, but have never visited, and are thinking, well, I'm not sure, you know, if this is really the place to visit, but, you know, is it the sort of place you could just go and sort of spend a couple of weeks, have a holiday? What's your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had wanted to go to Cuba for many years and didn't go, partly because I was told by a friend of mine, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago even, that he went to Cuba on a scuba diving holiday, and he was in what I now know must have been Baradero. So there were, you know, a gated area and very sectioned off from the Cuban people, and that is not the way it is now, and that was part of the reason I didn't want to go beforehand. So now you know, it's a place where they are very proud of their safety record in terms of street crime, for example. It's very low, and they have a lot of people now engaging in offering private rooms in their own houses. So I wanted to go and actually see what life was like for Cubans, and I had that opportunity, and I'd say that is available to a lot of people, and it's a shame not to do that. So I would always recommend, a lot of people seem to go just for 2 or 3 days in Havana, and then they go off to the beach. Now, that's fine, except that you're going to see a beach hotel, which is much the same as any other hotel. So that's, in my view, that's a shame, because actually spending time in places like Havana and Cienfuegos or Trinidad actually gives you a richer experience of what we might call the real Cuba. And then, yeah, sure, go and have 5 days on the beach. But in my view, make that less.
Are there many connections between Bristol and Cuba? Do you think, you know, there's quite a bit of exchange? Because Bristol's a traditional port, isn't it? I mean, for centuries it was.
That's an interesting question, Tony. I will look at that. I'm not, apart from us, I don't know what other connection there is regularly between Bristol and Cuba.
Maybe better just tell us about this talk you're giving in a couple of weeks, where it is, and, you know, what's the content of it going to be?
Yeah. Okay. So on the 18th of June, starting at 7:30, but with the doors open at 7 p.m., we're talking about Cuba Revolution, Solidarity and Palestine.
Okay, that's a Thursday evening.
It's a Thursday evening, and it's been held at the Palestinian Museum on Broad Street, BS1. So we'll be upstairs there. The tickets are £8. They're available. There is a Facebook page for this, and they're available through Eventbrite. They will be available on the door as well. And there will be food, some food available there, and we will then be playing Cuban music. And anyone who wants to have a dance can do that, because that's one of the things I did say to a friend of mine one time. When I first met Aris, and I said, "Oh," they said, "What's he like?" And I heard, "What does he like?" rather than "What is he like?" And I said, "Oh, he likes dancing." And he just looked at me. He was actually Colombian. He looked at me, and he said, "He's Cuban. Of course, he likes dancing." So there will be music, and will be the content will be expanding further on Cuba, its solidarity, and how that ties with Palestine. And 40% of the proceeds of the will be going to the Palestinian Museum in Bristol.
Whereabouts to would you recommend, if people are interested in following up sort of links between Britain and Cuba? Is there any kind of organisation that links the two countries?
Currently, well, there's the Cuba Solidarity Campaign, which has regional offices. There's also Rock Around the Blockade, which I've come across recently, which has regional groups. And I'm not aware of others specifically at the moment, but and also at the moment travel to Cuba. To go from the UK to Cuba, there's only one airline that does direct regular flights. And they like to sell their package deals. Now, an alternative is from Madrid, because there's obviously partly because of the Spain link.
Well, and also you can get to Madrid so cheaply, can't you?
Very.
Yeah.
And
okay, folks, hop via Spain if you're going over to Cuba. Don't bother with the. We won't even mention the name of the dreaded airline that's got the monopoly from Britain to Cuba. One final question, though. Look, I've got to ask: McDonald's in Havana? Is there a McDonald's? Is there going to be?
There isn't at the moment, and it's kind of a joke. People are seeing it. Well, no, I can't see it at the moment.
Well, I mean, it's funny because I was in Russia last summer and I saw a thing and I thought, this looks a bit like McDonald's. Of course, they do have McDonald's all over Russia, but there was one which I thought, this is perfect for Cuba, which was a Che Guevara fast food restaurant with the famous Che Guevara picture on the top of it, you know, and you get a little Che Guevara on your receipt and little Che Guevara kind of napkins and things like that. But that might go down well in Cuba, that chain.
Yeah, that chain might work, yes.
Okay, anyway, Jackie and Aristides, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin Summers, we're going to talk now about this film Invisible Empire, but before we hear the clip from it, this is another one of those films that goes into this whole thing of New World Order, and they believe, the people making this film, that the JFK assassination really set something in train back in the 1960s, which has led to a kind of rise of soft fascism right across the world, in fact particularly in the West. What's your thoughts about this term New World Order, and how helpful or unhelpful do you think it is?
Well, I mean, I think it's somewhat unhelpful because people project onto it whatever they want to project onto it. So, you know, there are as many New World Orders as the people talking about New World Order. But if we're talking about the JFK assassination, it was an inflection point. The American writer Peter Dale Scott, who is a Canadian diplomat, he sees the JFK assassination as a key turning point in the corruption of US politics. And of course it was related to the Cuban Revolution, because the attempt to invade Cuba by mercenary forces had been turned back at the Bay of Pigs, and Kennedy refused to provide air support, US air support, for the enterprise, and the Lyman Lemnitzer and the general staff in the US saw it as one of the reasons, only one of the reasons, why Kennedy had to go. Well, I think any serious analysis of the assassination shows that it was an inside job by the US security forces.
We did, didn't we, back 18 months or so ago, a special on the JFK assassination, where we heard from Lyndon Johnson's girlfriend that the night before, Lyndon Johnson appeared without an announcement, actually at a place, at a house where he was getting together with some of the big oil people in Texas and actually planning the assassination of JFK. So what
George Bush Senior was also in Dallas that day.
So, but you see, also the Bush family were involved in a coup attempt in the United States before World War II. Very few people know
that. Prescott Bush, the grandparent of George W. Bush, was involved in the attempt to overthrow Roosevelt in the late 30s because of his pro, you know, working class policies. They didn't like them.
So there was an actual attempted coup in the United States.
Yes, there was. They approached the First World War hero Smedley Butler, who was the former head of the U.S. Marine Corps, and they suggested to him that he should be the figurehead for this, you know, overthrow of Roosevelt. And Butler, in a very cunning move, just talked to all of the top conspirators, including Prescott Bush, who was the grandfather, and when he got all the information, he went straight to Roosevelt and said, these people are plotting to overthrow the government of the United States, what do you want me to do about it? And they were all dealt with. Prescott Bush was also interned during World War II for trading with Nazi Germany, because he had lots of interests in Germany. And of course, this is the hidden history of the Bush crime family. These are the kind of people that run the US, and they were linked to the mafia who were running Cuba under Batista.
So there was a whole background of this kind of fascism, and they were dealing with the Nazis as well during the Second World War in the US. And of course it carried on, didn't it, with the Dulles brothers, and Hoover as well was actually very sympathetic to these people. And as you said there yourself, George H.W. Bush, the former president of the US. So although his father had been involved in a coup, he was considered okay to be standing for president.
Well, indeed, and therefore, you know, if you kill people off, like Allende in Chile, the purpose of that is to close down options for the future, and to, you know, to control the outcomes in the interests of elite groups.
Okay, well, let's hear a clip now anyway from this film Invisible Empire, which you can find on the internet. I'll put a link to it on our show page, thisweek.org.uk.
Nazi forces seek to establish systems of government based on the regimentation of all human beings by a handful of individual rulers who seize power by force.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society.
And the hope that each of us has to build a new world order.
A new world order is coming into being, but it looks less and less like the world order that Mr. Kissinger had constructed in his own mind.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
What is the Bohemian Grove? Well, it's a kind of summer camp for the powerful. Among its members, political figures like Gerald Ford, President Reagan, Vice President Bush, Richard Nixon is a Bohemian. Each year, guests like Henry Kissinger or Zbigniew Brzezinski address members on their areas of expertise.
Be a poster child for these people because you have served on the board of the Council on Foreign Relations, you helped start the Trilateral Commission, and you've been to the Bilderberger groups.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy.
I don't believe in this notion of some sort of secret societies controlling people. But, of course, in any political system, there are sort of over-the-table and under-the-table arrangements.
It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine
by the military-industrial complex.
Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised.
We can find meaning and reward by serving some higher purpose than ourselves. A shining purpose, the illumination of 1,000 points of light.
No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
The quest for the new world order is in part a challenge to keep the dangers of disorder at bay.
We were interested today to hear that more than 100 law enforcement officials in Mexico are having microchips implanted in their arms. The chips allow a person to be scanned, sort of like a cereal box at the supermarket checkout.
I think the most important thing is for Barack Obama.
I think his task will be to develop an overall strategy for America in this period when really a new world order can be created.
I think the new world order is emerging, and with it the foundations of a new and progressive era of international cooperation.
But the burdens of global citizenship continue to bind us together. In this new century, Americans and Europeans alike will be required to do more, not less. Partnership and cooperation among nations is not a choice.
Yes, these men and their hypnotized followers call this a new order. It is not new, and it is not order.
I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people.
Well, it's quite ironic, Martin, isn't it, that that's the speech about secret societies, and I think it was also referring to communism as well. It was trying to blame communism. Was made by Kennedy not long before he was assassinated. Is it possible to convince you that there is some currency to this idea that there is an attempt to dominate the world that's come out of the Kennedy assassination post World War II?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think that's definitely what's been going on. We've got corporate fascists attempting to run things from behind the scenes. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the problem with the term New World Order is that people get carried away by the term itself. You can call it whatever you like. Let's just call it fascism. Let's just call it brutality. Let's just call it inhumanity.
But we've heard some of the most powerful people in the US there, George Bush Sr. using it in that clip, Henry Kissinger. These are powerful people, aren't they? And it's a term that they're using.
Yeah, I think if we're going to narrow it down, the New World Order is essentially America's global bid for world dominance, supported by Britain and Israel. That's the bottom line.
Okay.
But I see some people think that Putin and the Chinese Communist Party are part of some New World Order conspiracy to bring foreign troops to the United States of America. Now, that's just wrong. The US, the Israelis and the Americans are the real axis of evil, and they're being opposed by Putin and the Chinese Communist Party and the Cuban Communist Party.
A minute,
but some people on the right in the US see the whole thing, including the communism and the Bolshevik Revolution, as being orchestrated by, for example, the Rothschild family. I find that more hard to believe. I think that what's fairly clear is going on is there's an Anglo-Zionist axis which is attempting to dominate the world, and there are other forces like Cuba, for example, which are trying to prevent it. Not all part of the same game.
Okay, surely powerful bankers in the US, the Rockefeller family, and in Europe, the Rothschild family, are behind this, aren't they? They've got to be.
They are indeed, but they're not behind the Chinese Communist Party, and they're not behind Vladimir Putin. But people on the right in the US who talk about a new world order try to put all these people into the same bag, and that's just frankly wrong.
Also an article by Joachim Hakipan in the Global Research website recently was saying the globalists' new world order, soft and hard kill methods, an unknown and uncertain future. He says we're living in some exciting yet scary times now. An unknown and uncertain future awaits us as today's events and developments unravel, revealing a myriad of warning signs, spelling doom and gloom of apocalyptic end days. As Christians, some Christians believe we're already entered in. I mean, I suppose what he's going on about here is this whole idea, partly anyway, that the United States is supposed to be a democracy, and nobody, surely, in the US is voting when they vote for their president or when they vote for their congressman for world domination, are they?
Well, some are because the choice of who you can vote for is controlled in the first place. So who gets onto the ballot paper? Well, you've got to be a multimillionaire to even get there. And of course, they do also just steal elections in the United States of America. George Bush Jr. stole two elections, not one, two elections, using electronic voting machines in Ohio the second time. And of course, anybody who really steps out of line, like Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, well, they just end up in six feet under. It's not really a democracy. It's an oligarchy ruled with fraud and force. And they're very dangerous.
One of the things that came up in that clip is this thing about microchip implants. So let's go back to have a listen to another clip from that interview we heard a bit from last week with Dr. Catherine Albrecht on The Mind Renewed.
When I was doing my dissertation research in 2005, I interviewed people about frequent shopper cards at the grocery store. I interviewed them about microchip implants very neutrally, very much saying it's a medical device, would you take it? And I had about 15% of people say they would, and the other ones were adamantly opposed. I mean, just like over my shotgun kind of answers, like they were, whoa, I don't know, hang on, not me, I'm not trying to do it. But there's been recent research within just the last couple of years that have shown that number of opposition has gone way down, and now according to some studies in some parts of the world, it's as high as 50% of people who say that if they could put their smartphone or their cell phone into a tiny implant in their hand, use it to buy and sell, that they would do it.
Really?
So we're now looking at really decreasing levels of opposition. And what I find the most fascinating, Julian, about this is that I grew up, as I said, in the 1970s, where I was exposed to the Mark of the Beast. It was in music on the radio. Right. There were television programs, movies. Everybody knew about it. They talked about it on Sunday in church. Mm. And we've now moved in just a few short decades to a point where even Christians who attend church every Sunday, you'll ask them about the Mark of the Beast, Christian teens, people in their 20s, and they'll say, what is that? Yes. The what of the, huh?
On 93.2, online and on your mobile.
Time to sign off now. We'll find this show on thisweek.org.uk. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
On the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Sepp Blatter will serve a fifth term as FIFA president. It's after